GM, hello everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Sulfate Podcast, where we talk with founders and builders in the Solana ecosystem. This is the Tolly episode. We have the founder, well, co-founder, the technical, you know, gibberish co-founder that is Tolly. You know, is such a really cool conversation with Tolly. Like, Tolly the man. Like, yeah, we got down and dirty into personal mindset and community growth of Solana and how really how Tolly's brain kind of works, which was really, really cool.
If you didn't think you could respect Anatoly more, I think you will be surprised by this episode, where you'll be like, oh my gosh, I respected his technical prowess, but also his self-awareness, right? Like he knows who he is. He knows how he ticks, and he takes advantage of that, right? Like we talked to him about, hey, how do you handle being sort of the tip of the spear in the Solana ecosystem with everything that's gone on over the last couple of years. And he could very succinctly describe how he is or who he is and why this works for him, you know, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating. He's a fascinating human being. And I hope that someday there are a bunch of biographies written about him.
There probably will be.
Anyway, anything
we're, let's get to the episode.
Let's just jump in. No teasers required. Listen to Tolly.
Yeah, and before we jump into the episode, big shout out to our sponsors for Underdog and Phantom. If you don't already know, Underdog's a great way to do low-code and no-code solutions in order to minting and managing all your NFTs on Solana. And Phantom, it's, you know, everyone's wallet they know and love. It's our favorite wallet. Shout out to Phantom and Underdog. Thanks.
All right, let's get into the episode.
Nothing in this podcast is or should be considered financial advice. Any opinions and thoughts expressed are solely those of the individual. They do not represent the opinions of any entity. Enjoy. You always talk about, you know, what's the next big thing on Solana, like from a technical advantage. And I remember the last time I heard you answer this question, it was localized fee markets. So I'm curious, from your perspective, what do you think's like the next technical advantage, technical hurdle for Solana as a protocol to tackle? And which one are you most excited about? Like, which one's the coolest to you?
Yeah, I think it's, this one's hard to get like over everyone over the line on. But it's, I think, asynchronous execution. And this is kind of like, I have this grand vision where Solana block produce, no, neither the block producer nor the nodes voting do any execution. They don't even know what the state is. All they care about is what is the next quorum. And that could be like floated out there by anybody's, and you can basically, and it's created like many days in advance, or many, like, you know, at least an epoch in advance, could be hours or days. And as long as nobody challenges it, that ends up being the next quorum. And that's all that the network does. And it's kind of weird to think about, to think that all it's doing is making blocks and voting. It never needs to execute any of those blocks. as it's creating blocks, it doesn't know what kind of blocks it's creating.
That's wild.
So what is
the thing that makes that hard to get sort of everyone on board with?
Everyone likes the idea. It's just, there's a lot of details, and those details mean kind of like stuff starts, needs to change and get aligned between all the teams. And when people talk about alignment, I think it's kind of a misused word in the industry, but really it's like any big open source project or any big company, when you're like an L7 or L8 engineer and you have like this big project trying to get across, you got to talk to like 20 different teams and get them all on the same page and be like, okay, yeah, this is what we're doing. Everyone agreed and everyone signed off. It's the same. It's a job. It's the same thing. Whether you do it in open source land or at a big company, you got to get everyone on board. And then once everyone agrees, that's a good idea, that's where we're going to, then there's a bunch of steps and the ordering matters. And like, but basically like, asynchronous execution, I think, is one of those things which will unlock a lot of the performance and decentralization benefits. And it's doesn't like make the chain any more powerful. So all it does is it means that the validators, when they make blocks, they only look at the information in the transaction, which is like kind of the access list or the accounts information that we have in Solana, which is mandatory and has to be complete. So based on that, they create blocks, and whatever the transaction, how many compute units it declared, that's, you can start estimating, or you know exactly how much is going to get used in the blocks. You know how to pack it. You create these blocks without knowing what the transaction does beyond that. All you care about is that like little bit of information from the accounts that for execution. And then for execution, similarly, when you're voting, you're just voting on forks. You care, all you care about is like, is the network agreed on the ordering? It doesn't really care about what the values are. And it's only once in epoch that you do this. Somebody needs to know, okay, what's the next quorum? So you can pre-compute it an epoch ahead and you post it. And if the network doesn't halt, then it's good. That's it.
Maybe this is a bit of an if statement there.
Yeah.
Maybe this is like a silly question, but if the state is not known, right? Like, how do you ensure, like, some of those blocks are going to be full of failed transactions because balances don't settle or that kind of thing. We're just saying we're okay with that loss,
yeah,
in exchange for the asynchronous, yep, nature.
Yeah, but what's cool about it is that people can post like the current snapshot, and you don't have to trust it. You don't have to have. You can use it without trusting it. It can be wrong, right? Like people can tell you this is what the current snapshot is of all the accounts. Some block producer, right, is making blocks and it's pulling the current state from an RPC node. It doesn't care. Like if it lies, it's not a big deal. And that's kind of the beauty of it. If like Mert's RPCs get corrupted or Mert goes rogue and you no longer trust their snapshot, you just switch to Triton. So like there's still people looking at the network and making sure it's running correctly. It's just you don't have those things as mandatory requirements that like things stop if they're wrong. It just happens that like you'll encode more failed transactions because your fee payer balances are out of date. And it's not a big deal, but it's very, if it happens, it's very easy to mitigate it. Just the operator switches to some other supplier of that information. And it's very easy to detect and observe. You don't have to do it in real time as you're making blocks. And that means that we can shrink block time to like 120 milliseconds and just everything becomes faster and tighter. And that's kind of the cool part.
So more performant. What is this? Look, obviously, like, I think everyone that's been here over the last couple of years, there is some underlying fear of the network stopping. Is this like making big changes like this? Does that scare you, or are you like, fuck it, we're here to make changes and improve things?
I think people are afraid of it, but they're not terrified of it. They know it sucks, okay, and they know if everyone's trying to avoid it happening.
It's like a healthy fear that people just need to have.
Yeah, all the engineers are doing their best, testing like everything. I think with FireDancer folks also looking at the design and stuff, there's now like multiple heads from coming in from it from different angles and verifying and testing everything. And it's making it more and more robust and far less likely for those bugs to occur, but it might happen. And that's, I think what's different about Solana than Ethereum is that I think most of the engineers and people are kind of willing to let that happen if it's for an order of magnitude improvement in performance or in safety. And especially safety is the subtle one. Like there's this big drama in Ethereum land about Geth having 85% or 80% distribution, which means that even if all the other client, if Geth has a bug and it diverges from the other clients, from Geth's point of view, all the other clients went offline and it's now doing, it's going to run. It's like, it's going to slash all the other clients until they're zero stake and the other clients are going to slash Geth and the network's going to diverge. And that's a bad outcome because the majority is going to be on Geth, and that majority includes Coinbase and Binance and everyone else.
When we have multiple clients, is that a concern on Solana?
So on Solana, we don't have an inactivity slashing leak. And also we have been through the gauntlet on outages. And
yes,
I mean, I'm going to push that people run two nodes, one FireDancer, one Labs, and if they diverge, they halt. And by people, I mean all the top staked validators. So I think for us, safety is so important that I'd rather see the network have an outage than the possibility of that divergence and bug existing. So this is where I think this comes with this, not being a direct child of Bitcoin. Bitcoin's like a grandparent, and you just don't care about Bitcoin as much when it's your grandparent.
I feel that. That's a good analogy. It's quite an analogy.
And Ethereum, it's Ethereum's parent, and it's like way too much influence, I think, over Ethereum as Bitcoin has.
Yeah, having that generation in between is definitely useful. Yep. For giving fewer fucks. I'm curious, like, when we're talking about this stuff, when we're talking about, hey, I want to add, this asynchronous nature to the network, that sort of thing. How much of that do you feel personally responsible for versus like, hey, we're a community. I obviously want to get people on board.
I can't do it on my own because I would have to work 24/7 and try to I don't even have like committer admin privileges. I have to commit like a normal external contributor to the code base to get people to get the maintainers to accept my changes. So yeah. It would be really hard for me to just do it on my own. I could fork Solana maybe and do it there, but I mean
how much pressure do you put on yourself to ensure these ideas happen? Because whether you want to be at this point or not, I think most of us view you as the tip of the spear.
I'm a stress seeker. Is what I discovered about myself. It's like there was one instance between jobs where like I almost started a company, like while our first baby was born, and then before our second, was born, I started Solana. And yeah, I'm a stress seeker basically all my life. I mean, before startups and kids, I was like an Iron Man, and like that was my outlet. I would just go find some like super extraneous physical activity. For some reason, okay. I don't know.
do you ever regret that? Are you like, do you sometimes be like, no, do I want to do this anymore? Or are you just like, no injuries.
One knee surgery, can't run anymore, but no like crippling injuries.
Okay.
Well, that's good. But
you're still, I mean, so you're still, as far as I can tell from like Twitter and stuff, you're still very physically active. You like lift and stuff.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So I switched from cardio because running is problematic to weightlifting, and that's been awesome. And similarly with work, I just like wake up, do my routine to get my coffee, and then I'm like, okay, how do we get to the next level? What's the next unblock? How do we make this thing faster? Whatever. I don't know. It's just what else would I be doing?
this feels like, I think we probably have some more technical questions, but this is a perfect time to ask one of my more personal questions, which is like, how do you balance the, like you've already mentioned sort of family life, you're married, you've got kids, you're apparently big into exercise, right? So you're lifting at least a few times a week, it sounds like, and you also work a bunch, like you're trying to solve technical problems. Like you mentioned before, you're trying to wrangle stakeholders and get people on board with these ideas you have. How do you shift from each of those things to the next without it feeling disruptive?
I think, I don't know if this is true for a lot of people, but like you basically, one of these things becomes like an obsession that you do in like all the time, even when you're idling. So like I'm kind of working all the time, which means that I can take my kids to school sometimes, or like, and I'm still thinking about work. It means I'm not really present as much as I should be, which is challenging. But I'm kind of like, I can basically overlap a bunch of stuff. If I'm working out, I'm probably half Twitter, half thinking about some meeting or like some design thing. So like a lot of things like that start kind of bleeding into it. And that's really, really tough on the present side with the kids and family.
I feel that.
Yeah, I bet.
And there was like really, really hard, challenging time. I was like in the bootstrapping 0-1 phase, because I had to like fundraise, do BD, and still code, because being like a good IC and only having so much runway, and I could be to 10% of the IC output, right? Like, and out of 10 engineers. That was tough. That was tough in the family. Basically, Laura like had to take over like majority of the family stuff that I was supposed to do. Plus, she also had a stressful job. So that was really tough. But that's just kind of what it takes. You know, I talked to my parents. They grew up in the Soviet Union, and their stories are much harder.
Fair enough.
Blessed. I'm blessed to be here.
It's all relative in the end.
You also grew up in like post-Soviet Union, right?
No, when we left, it was basically right after the war, the wall like came down. So like this was 91.
Okay.
So yeah, what I remember, I was 11, went to Chicago. Okay. It's like,
got it.
The Bulls just won their first championship, and I'm like coming from communism into Chicago, and Jordan was, being bigger than life as an 11-year-old kid. You
was
know?
That a huge culture clash?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. I have a close buddy who's from Ukraine. And like, I mean, he was there until he was like in his 20s, was when he came over here. But he tells me stories about like the stuff they did as 11, 12 year olds in Ukraine. And I'm like, holy crap. It's a different world.
Yeah. My wife says it's like I grew up in the 40s. Like even the photos, like, because they're all like at home, like developed. They're like, these look like they were taken in the 40s.
That is kind of the mental picture quality that my buddy has given me. Yeah. He's like, he said when they were kids, he's like, we used to find anything that had like color on it, and we'd like collect it. Like if we find cans that had color, we'd make these collages on our wall of things that were colorful, because so much of our stuff was like undesigned labels.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. There was no branding. It's just kind of weird. Everything was handmade. A lot of things were handmade, and like community garden and stuff like that. It was Portland, basically. It's like the dream.
modern day dream, but like at the time was not the dream.
Yeah. Nope.
How does that make you feel about, you know, Portland?
It's a dream if it's by choice, right? Like, and you get to selectively do those things when you feel like it, right? And like go to the farmer's market and pick out really expensive vegetables because you're not thinking about calories, right? Like,
yeah, that's very good point.
Yep.
How influenced by those first 10, 11 years of your life do you think you are now? Like how much of you is a result of that versus sort of US culture?
I don't know. It's a good question. I almost don't remember it. It was such a long time ago, and different language in my brain, you know, now thinks in English, and then I was thinking in like Russian, right? So like, and it wasn't even like modern day Ukraine that's like westernized and capitalist but it was like the Soviet one where we had like Lenin pins and shit like that everywhere.
So different times. So it was, different times.
It's definitely, I can remember it, but it doesn't feel real. It feels like, was that real? Like, is this, did this actually exist?
Was this just a dream that I've had multiple times to where like it feels present?
Exactly.
That's wild. I can't imagine. What are your hobbies and interests outside of, maybe outside of stress seeking? Do you have any hobbies that are not stress seeking?
snowboarding, but like I started to level
still
up.
Still kind of stress seeking though. You're looking for that adrenaline rush from it at least.
I don't. Yeah, I try not to tell my wife where I'm going snowboarding.
Because you're doing like backcountry stuff.
Backcountry. Backcountry snowboarding and like being out there in the trees and stuff like that. Surfing I used to love, and like 2 years ago I went again in SF, and it kind of scared me because I'm out of practice, and when you eat it in like shallow water on a like a fast wave, like a hard beach break, you're falling in like 2-3 feet of water pretty fast. And I hit my shoulder and everything. I was like, oh man, this could have ended badly. So surfing, I think like, I'm not as, risk seeking, but I do like stress. Like, I know when to like step back and be like, this is too much. I don't need to do this, but, I like the physical challenge. So probably snowboarding, weightlifting right now. Those are my two main ones that I have time for. You can overlap it with like get a bunch of crypto founders, or you can kind of overlap it with work. Get a bunch of people together, you go snowboarding, you're forced to like get to know each other and like build those relationships.
Okay. That's
I feel like a lot of those types of activities, especially when you're like in a higher stress, more adrenaline focused, doing an adrenaline focused thing, where it's like, if you have a bunch of people that are all doing that together, like the camaraderie that you're going to build, especially if you're, riffing on random ideas, like that's got to be great for, especially founer level team building. So I could, I could see that.
Especially sure. Like you're doing backcountry stuff. You guys are hiking for hours on end together and in the middle of nowhere.
I think interestingly, I think the trauma that Solana went through as an ecosystem was a trauma bonding experience.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't wish on anyone else, but I think it's almost a requirement to get like stickiness, ecosystem stickiness, is to go through that, like through the trenches, and get people that are willing to kind of do or die and stick with you.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the last 1 year ago when like that thing happened, like the trauma bonding that happened in the ecosystem, so many people left that were just here for the wrong reasons, and like everyone that stayed for all the right reasons, and like the community just flourished in so many ways. I think trauma bonded for win.
Yep.
I feel actually super lucky to have been here through that through that period, but also like was early enough in that I didn't have a lot of financial stakes tied to anything, right? So I kind of came in and just got to experience things excuse me, for the community and the tech, and things like the FTX implosion didn't affect me financially, but then I got to like live through the last year and change with everyone, and like see the community flourish, which was awesome. I can't imagine the last year and a half or so being more emotionally impactful on many people than it was on you. So I am curious, like you've always seemed so level about everything. Did it always did it feel that way? or was that just sort of like talk to the world, but internally
I've got like, due to my stress seeking, whatever genetics, I have pretty low heart rate. I played the sport underwater hockey and you hold your breath and it's competitive. That's nuts. And you're supposed to like redline it, right? And like sprint, but also keep your heart rate as low as possible to like
like incompatible goals.
Yeah.
So to be fair, I think everything about Solana is that as well, right? It's like, we're going to, you know, that's a theme in your life right now, is like, let's redline it and keep this heart rate thing low.
That's where the opportunities are, right? Is when like in the really hard parts to optimize, where you have a lot of things that are pulling in each other in different directions. If you can just like nail it, you get an order improvement over somebody else.
Okay. I have a, I have a question for my personal benefit, which is I hear like a lot of what you're saying about like stress seeking, that kind of stuff. I relate to that a little bit, but I also think I'm far more risk averse than you are. But you seem to have navigated this stress seeking impulse, if you will, in like a really good way. You're not, you know, you don't have a million broken bones.
I'm cautious. So I will like slowly, like I'll do the same run like 20, 30 times before I get comfortable taking like the jump bigger. Right. Like,
okay.
I get a lot out of like understanding the course and like, I would say I'm a pretty slow learner, like in that sense.
Is there a part of how you do things that you think is learnable? Like, how much of what you're describing is just like, yeah, this is just how I'm wired. I just came like this, versus you're like, hey, yeah, you could learn to do this better if you did X, Y, Z.
I mean, like,
benefit piece, right?
Yeah, I'm not a great athlete by any means. Like, there's always somebody I think that part is easy. Like, that's just practice. I think for the startups, a lot of the stuff I got lucky on in retrospect, like, I think we didn't raise as much as our competitors. I remember Algorand and Hashgraph and all these other folks raised like 60, 100 mil, whatever, plus. And we like raise like a 2-3 mil seed round, and then like I think 14 or something like that in the A, and that's much smaller amount of money to work with. And I couldn't hire, like, I just had to be like, I knew that I couldn't hire like an infinite size team, so that forced me into a particular strategy. And I knew that we couldn't build everything, like we couldn't build EVM support and all this other stuff. So that forced me into a particular strategy that ended up being right in retrospect. And that's really, really hard for a founder to have that. Like, you read all these books and they tell you, okay, you're building a startup for this outsized outcome, not for the medium outcome. So you have to have a vision that's outsized. And then you have to find the key differentiator part of that vision that can both prove the vision and like be the differentiator from all your competitors. And like, that's, you can read it and say that to yourself, but in the moment you're going to be like, all the developers are in EVM. I should build EVM support. Right. And like, if we had infinite money or more, like five times as, you know, as much as our competitors, I would have been like, well, all our competitors are building EVM support. We must also build EVM support, right? Otherwise, we're not going to get the devs. But it turns out that was like the best decision that I could have made, is that we built a runtime that was optimized purely for performance. It proved the thing that was different about Solana from anything else. And it was in Rust, which is like a very popular language, but not EVM. So we got our own crew of devs that loved Rust over anything else and loved the thing that the runtime unlocked that Solidity didn't do. So that was like not something that you can predict, because it's a high risk, high reward thing. So like that part and those lessons, like when you raise capital and people trust you with it and to go build a company, you do have this big vision, but you're also like, how do I like minimize risk? How do I like make sure that people are okay, right? Like, how do we not fail? And that means that you end up being very conservative in your decision making, and that's not always right. That's kind of like sometimes having a forcing function, like a very limited runway, you can only do one thing. What is it going to be?
it's a huge blessing. How much did you go back and forth on that versus just like, no, this is the move?
We just didn't have an option. I was like, let's just build it. Let's get it to work in testnet for like have it run for more than 2 weeks, and then we go mainnet as soon as it's stable for at least a couple of weeks, then we go live, because our runway was 20, we were measuring it in months. You don't have the option to be like, okay, so in these 6 months we do this and then we do that and then maybe we evaluate EVM or not. You're like, we have 18 months of runway left and we still don't have it working. Then we have 17 months and it's still not working, right?
obviously, like, what ifs never mean much because you didn't live that second path. But indulge me for a second. And, like, I'm curious, like, how would you have handled the quote-unquote failure if things didn't pan out, right? Like, if 12 months in, Solana was like, we can't keep this going anymore. How does that affect you personally if that's the outcome? I guess what I'm really asking is like, how much of your sense of self is contingent on success?
That would have been so depressing.
There we go. That's exactly what I'm getting to.
Yeah.
But you've done things in the past that haven't panned out.
Yeah. Right? Well, if it's like, as soon as it's a year behind you, you kind of like forget about it. It's just that in the moment, and you know that you're going to kind of go through some shit, you got to tell everybody that, you know, it works for you. And like, that sucks. Like, just letting people go sucks. Literally. So before we launched in 2020, we tried to like raise a bigger bridge round and we couldn't. And we let go like a third of the team just to extend our runway. And then we launched in March, like as soon as we could, again, under pressure. Like, so at that moment I was like, oh yeah, what happens in month 9 is like when we have about a month is I tell everyone like, look, you got 4 weeks, go find another job. Sorry guys, we failed. And then I take a couple months off and I got kids. I got to get back. I got to work.
That's a lot of pressure.
Quite the emotional hit, I'm sure. Yeah.
And like, it was really something. There's something like that you can kind of like not feel it as much when a major external event happens. So we announced our auction and then 2 days later was March 16th, where like the markets, like this is March 16th, 2020 or whatever, when all the markets tanked. The world was on fire. Investors were like, we don't know what to do. They're like, welcome, we think we're fucked. We think we're going to have to shut down the fund in like 2 weeks. I have no advice for you. So at that moment, I was like, we have, yeah, like I think 6 or 7 months of runway left. My theory is maybe dumb, was that the worst possible time to launch would have been right before it. Because then everything crashes and all the people's expectations and price and everything else is wrong. So your community gets screwed, whatever you built up. So right after is not the worst possible time. And you can never time the market. So it's actually like you have the most information out of any other point in time in the world. You're like right after the crash. If we launch now, anyone that joins and goes in is like the crazy true believers. Those are the people that we want as core of the community. And that was kind of the rationale to just go for it. And had we had more runway and like a bigger team, I would have been like, well, the market's not right. We should wait. Again, delaying and stuff like that. Terrible mistake. Raj and I internally, like when we're trying to push something, we call those people delayers. There's always like a group of delayers that you gotta like fight through. Usually the lawyers.
Usually the lawyers. Yep. That makes sense. Speaking of Raj, like what's your guys' relationship like? Obviously you work super closely together. How close are you work independent?
We don't like need to see each other, do a lot of Zoom stuff. Like during COVID really like reshaped how we work, because we were basically in a Zoom that was open like 24/7, like during that year. And we kind of mind melded, I would say, during that year. I met him through a friend of mine when I first had the idea to build a blockchain. This guy that I've been friends with for 20 years, he's like a Higgs. He's on the Higgs boson paper. He's a CERN particle physicist. He was working with Raj on data science at Amada Health. And he's like, you should talk to Raj. He's awesome. He's raised money before. No startups, then you don't know anything beyond engineering.
He is the other piece that you should talk to.
Right, exactly. So we met. Raj was like, this seems cool. I kind of think Ethereum is cool. Had no clue about crypto. And it's like, I'll give you 6 months. I'll help you get the round together and hire some people. And that was the start of that 6 years ago. Yeah, and we it was weird. Like, I think... there were moments, I think, in those first 2 years where he kind of had nothing to do. And I think I had to like work to keep him like there, like not to leave, like get him excited, give him stuff.
Just because he was like, I need a challenge and this isn't doing it for me right now.
Yeah. Okay. He didn't quite say anything like that, but I could tell that he was like getting bored. Because all we're doing is engineering and like our optimistic timelines are always getting delayed because we'll hit like one issue after another, after another. But once the network launched, you could see him light up and like become like start. He, all the kind of like, I think branding and ecosystem, like initial like roots of all of the stuff came from him. Like the initial ideas he would, basically like, yeah, I don't think Solana would be here without him. Just kind of, it's the tag, but it's also like everything else. Like I think everything else is a huge part of it too.
Oh, for sure. I mean, look, that's what Mert harps on this all the time, that it's like devs forget that marketing matters, community matters, you know, spreading awareness, information, that kind of thing.
I'm curious, how much did you have to convince Raj of like, hey, this is going to be not EVM, not Ethereum? Or was it like an immediate, he was convinced?
He didn't care about any of that.
He didn't care. He was like, blockchain, that sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. He cares about user experience. And when he like tries to use something and it's complicated and stuff, he like barfs all over it. So he's got a good knack for that. And like, he does, I mean, he can like build a website. He's not an engineer, but he understands tech. Right. And, I don't know if it was him that convinced Phantom to build on Solana first, or evaluating a bunch of blockchains, but he spent a lot of time talking to them and was super excited about them in those early days. We're like, they're really, really good designers. MetaMask sucks. We need like a team like that to be a flagship wallet versus like anyone else. So when he finds like a team that has like an eye for building something beautiful, he really, really goes for it. And tries to get him across the line.
That's huge. I'm not gonna lie. Like Phantom's UX is a big reason that I like stuck around. You know,
we got lucky with them being the first wallet, because like usually the first wallet is who kind of sets the standard. The majority of users kind of gravitate towards it. And this is, again, if you're EVM compatible, you inherit all the cruft of the EVM ecosystem and you're stuck with it. It's really, really hard to like undo it.
Plus, it's hard to build just good user experience, period, if you don't have the speed and everything else that comes with Solana. Like, game changing.
Yeah, it's like both sides of that definitely matter. I like you've been incredibly humble in saying that like some of this was just luck and being forced into certain decisions, but you clearly had the wherewithal to like make those hard decisions anyway. And that, you know, there, you definitely deserve some credit there as well, Raj, as well, right? Okay. It's like all of you who are involved there, it's like, yeah. It's something like Solana doesn't just happen entirely because of, you know, good fortune.
Our decision-making process was like us arguing to exhaustion. And my point was that like, that's part of the process, because then you have the options are like basically Pareto efficient. You've argued them to exhaustion. Whatever's left, it doesn't matter what you pick. If you like went through all the trade-offs and you cannot get rid of these three options,
that's good.
You're like at that space.
For anyone listening who's arguing with a business partner,
that's part of the process. Have done that before you.
It is the way.
I'm very curious to hear, to like maybe learn more about what motivates you. I've heard you say many times before that you like just like solving fun tech problems. But also I don't think anyone's in, you know, the crypto space who doesn't have a more long-term sort of slightly grander vision about like how this changes some part of the world. And so I'm curious how much of your motivation is just that day-to-day I'm solving fun problems versus that maybe more like 20, 30 year, I want to affect change on the world.
I just like competition. I'd say that's my main motivator. Like I care about all those things, but I would be working on something, but I like competing and I want to.
So if there were no Ethereum, there'd be no Solana, just because you need to compete. Is that?
I don't know. That's that's very much possibly true. Like the reason why I liked even working on high performance code at like in my career is because I can make something faster than anyone else. I could point to it and say, look, my benchmarks beat everyone else's. There was a thing and I made it better and it's the best. I kind of have this intrinsic need to do that. I do like get excited about like the broader kind of science fiction dream of like there's this one computer that's synchronized at the speed of light. That feels like that should be part of the future, and like trying to accelerate that and bring it, you know, get it in the present instead of like thinking about it 20, 30 years from now, I think is pretty cool. In that sense, like I think that's pretty important. You know, like I think it's hard to attribute like a bigger mission to any individual action. Like saving, like I don't know if blockchain is saving the world. Like that's just kind of feels cheesy to me, right? And not honest. I think only in like the very broad sense where everyone that's trying to improve something in the world is saving the world, right? All the people that are trying to like make something better. You know, every one of those individual contributions is like slowly getting us to wherever, you know, like a better place. Growth, right? Abundance of things, like lifting people out of poverty. Like, I don't think blockchain alone does it, but like, it's the fact that everyone is working towards like improving things. That is, I would say, that part is important. Yeah, this is kind of like, just if I'm being honest with myself, I like competing.
So getting the thing that gets you up out of bed each day is beating the next guy.
I don't think about it that way. I don't actually think about the next guy as I'm building something. I'm like, I build it and I try to get it as good as possible. And then I look and see, oh man, it's like, in the top 5%, that's pretty good. How do I get it to the top then, right? Like I it's more that, like I like the challenge. And I think if I build something that was already the best, I'd probably still want to improve it. Yeah. I don't even know if it's like, I get like satisfaction from knowing it, that I beat a bunch, beat someone, but I would still think I'd want to improve it even intrinsically.
That, I mean, that's probably the best kind of competitor, right? Yeah. Someone who's not, it's like, there's such a thing as a sore winner and yeah. No one likes that.
Yeah. I get I think similarly, like surfing or snowboarding, like I get joy like failing over and over and eating it and then figuring it out and getting it to work. And then like, oh man, like I finally got it. Right. And that like, it's good to compare yourself with other people, but I think the satisfaction is like actually achieving that one thing on your own and figuring it out and getting that like better understanding of like whatever skill you're trying to build.
Yeah. I feel like culture puts a lot of pressure on like career though, that makes it sometimes feel different than just snowboarding. Right. Like I totally get that when it comes to just like, yeah, I'm going to go snowboarding. I want to learn how to do a rail or something. Right. And it's like, I'm going to do it and I'm going to fall a million times before I get it. But that's part of the process and it feels fun. It doesn't feel fun for all of us when it's career. You know, like when it's work related, how have you been able to make that? Like you've talked about these things interchangeably.
Yeah.
And they're not interchangeable for everyone, but they clearly are for you. And I'm like, how have you made that the case for yourself?
Like, I think that's like certain careers are easier, right? Like I think as an engineer in California, you can basically like, if you're always building towards like improving your skill set, like I really, for whatever reason, liked operating systems. So I kept working on those problems. And it's not like they were the hot thing, right? Like Linux was in the 90s, Microsoft and kind of fought it out. And you kind of thought, oh, operating systems are dead. And there was some of that stuff happening in mobile, but it wasn't like apparent to anyone that that's going to be like important. And it was important, I think, for mobile to a point. And it only like 20 years into my career where like crypto came around and I was like, this is a whole new OS that's completely a paradigm shift from everyone else. And I know how to build it really fast. It was like luck, right? That part, again, was luck. But I liked the challenge all through my career. And I think as an engineer, you're blessed in the sense that like if you work on really hard problems, you can translate that to any other job and it's pretty easy to like kind of get hired as an IC. Like I think if you start going into like product management and the management side, you career and network and kind of like those relationships you build become more important than your skill set. I think if you stick to being an IC and you go deeper into like execution, your expertise becomes kind of like the outlier and that's pretty powerful kind of like thing to have in your career. So it's different, I think. Like, I think, I don't know. Like, some folks go through that. Like, lawyers end up starting their practice, architects, doctors, right? Like, it's kind of maybe natural progression. When you hit, like, 10, 15 years of doing something, like a skill where you get to mastery, it's pretty easy to go on your own, I think, at that point, or take that risk. So this is like a very different totally path for like a founder than you go to college, get a PhD in something that is hot, like AI, and then you start a company right after. I feel like that's the movie version, right, of a startup founder. But like, I think actually, if you look at returns for funds, it's probably the folks with 10 plus years of industry experience that start successful companies. And I think
companies in your 30s and 40s.
Yeah. After you hit like that terminal, like skill set level where you're like, okay, I'm a master at this. Right. And I think the benefit that you didn't realize that you have, but now I know, is that you have a very deep network of people that are also experts. Just simply from working with people like for 10 years, you know, my friends ended up being GPU expert, compiler expert, like networking expert, all the stuff that you need to build an OS. Like, but they were just my buddies from Qualcomm that were there with me for like over a decade.
Nice. I like that. That gives hope, I think, to a lot of people. I think a lot of people feel like if you haven't started a company by the time you're 25, you never will, you know?
So like in tech, the only way that you could do that is, my view is that you have a PhD in something that is like on the cusp of becoming commercialized, like AI is right now. I think, again, that becomes a very small set of people, and it's not, I would say typically it's like much higher risk.
Yeah, I mean, having so many years of experience in any particular field, whether it's a technical one or not, like you de-risk it in a way. And I'm sure, like, especially if you're trying to raise funds, like everyone who would be a fundraiser or a fund giver, you know, they recognize that as a strong de-risking factor. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
What's weird is they don't. Is like there are a lot of VCs have this weird expectation. Is it's a hot space. I need 20-year-old kids that have no experience in building high performance software to go build high performance software, or like professors, right? Like this professor has an insight that's academic. And
is that just like the older you get, you're not able to do revolutionary things because like, is that the underlying,
I don't know. It's weird
reason for that. Like
there are definitely funds obviously that are able to kind of dig a little deeper, but I think, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting.
I could see it like a personal dedication thing where it's like, the older someone gets, the likelier they are to have a family and have all these other things going on in life, where it's like, you know, some 22-year-old, you know, might have just finished college, has this idea. It's like, they're not, to put it kindly, they're not burdened by the rest of life. They have so much more time. Yep. They will eat ramen noodles and stay up 14 hours working without taking a break. And I could see it that way, I guess.
Yeah, I think like the outlier that was unique to us is that there are like four of us were Ironmen.
Clearly so, dedicated.
Yeah, so you can like basically we cut out the working out and now focus work and all the time that you'd spend working out on one job. It actually ended up like pretty good.
Nice. It was a good bet. So it's paid off so far for everyone who took the risk on a quote unquote old person, you know, in their 30s. I guess we're coming to time, so I'll hold off on any further questions here. I want to make sure, like, is there anything that's on your mind right now that you want to get across to the community? Specifically our listeners, most of our listeners are Solana devs. You know, is there anything that you want to say?
I think this is probably the, like, a real, like, you kind of get these ups and downs in crypto markets, right? In cycles. And like, this is one of the best times to actually go into it and start, because it's not dead. Everyone clearly knows it's not dead or dying. So you don't have to fight uphill trying to convince people to fund your ideas. It's a little easier right now, but it's still, I think, well before the peak of the cycle. And I think nobody knows how long the cycle is going to last and stuff, but like, it's a pretty good time to go start a company. I would say go try the hackathon. The Solana Foundation /Coliseum hackathon. It's like probably the easiest way to enter the ecosystem.
Nice. All right. Builder's gonna build. I think that's
builder's gonna build hackathons. Starts March 1st, March 4th. Yeah,
we'll throw that in the show notes and make sure people know where to find it and get started.
Also, if you want to help me disrupt the duopoly, go pre-order the second Solana mobile phone or device.
Oh yeah, Saga 2. Get your pre-orders in. I've got my production Saga. Nice. My DVTs back here.
Nice.
I've got my DVT right here, actually. Nice. And then I did pre-order the second rare one.
Nice. Awesome.
That's super rare.
It was crazy that the day that we announced the pre-orders, Supreme Court like rejected all of Epic's like appeals.
Great timing.
And then, yeah, right? And then they came out with this like insane plan to charge people for web-based purchases, which is wild.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. Thank you so much for joining us. This was
thanks a lot.
This was so much fun for us.
For sure.
You know, it's I love hearing, I don't know, all the things we talked about, right? Motivations and what gets you out of bed in the morning, that kind of stuff. So thank you for being willing to delve into some personal stuff and share like your inner thoughts. I appreciate it.
For sure.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Tolly.
All right. To the listeners, we'll see you guys next time. So long, folks.
Bye-bye.